Voices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting. Welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm Scott McNally, and of course, with me, as always, Dr. Scott Stevenson. What is up, brother? It's been a couple weeks since we've spoke on the show, that is. I've been messaging with you because I'm pumped up for this Arnold this weekend. Are you ready to go? How you doing? Is everything packed?
This is going to be, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I've got an Airbnb, which I was so happy to get. It's really close, and I got a washer dryer in there.
Oh, nice.
I'm even thinking like I'll just pack for like 3 days and then just wash the stuff and wear it again.
That's a great idea right there.
Yeah, I'm going to go super light. So, it always feels like, you weigh the suitcase and I got a training belt in there and I got my boots and I went train legs and like all the other junk. I actually sent myself a box with like protein powders.
Oh,
and
perfect. Just, like,
there's a market. It's actually really close to the convention center. People can find it. I think if you go straight west, it's like an open air market where they've got all sorts of fresh seafood and vegetables and that kind of stuff. So
nice.
Yeah, I'm going to go over there and go get just basic food.
Okay.
And then I, brought some of the, like sauces and condiments and things that I normally would be eating. And so I sent those to myself. I have an awesome host.
Nice.
She's super cool. And I've got all like my food for the week is basically set, and I just need to pack some stuff to wear and thicker stuff than I'm used to.
I bet this is going to be par for the course for me, but definitely like different climate than Florida.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I might pack one pair of shorts, like just in case or something like that.
Yeah.
Other than workout shorts, but this is super going to be super exciting.
It's going to be a cool week, man. I'm pumped. I'm really excited for the seminar that you and John are doing that we've been talking about endlessly here. And I've been pumping it up on social media. I posted over at the Mountain Dog Diets Facebook page the other day to kind of take the temperature, see who all was showing up and stuff. And yeah. I'm excited. I'm excited for more than just the donuts, too. I want to see the whole thing.
That donuts place, I even had someone who was here in town, and she's dieting, and I looked to see if they have low fat donuts, because she does kind of her approach is, I guess, low fat.
Okay.
So she could handle some carbs, maybe. Maybe she probably will do cardio or workout in the morning beforehand, so then she could have a low fat. But I couldn't find, like, they don't even care on the Amy's Donuts site. It's just they have like 200 kinds of donuts, but they don't even like try to make, this is gluten free or these are low fat or these are vegan. Like, these are just donuts.
Yeah. Like, they're like, look, you're eating donuts. Just accept that.
you stop thinking, overthinking it. Just eat the donut and enjoy it.
Right. Right.
But some of them, I mean, you can go to the site. I think it's just like amysdonuts.com. I don't even know what the donuts are. Like there's so many names and they don't have descriptions of what's on them. So you're kind of like, I guess if you were at the store, you could actually see them, but it looks like a lot of the ordering goes on online. You can order a dozen donuts or several dozen and just have them ready for pickup when you arrive, which is what we're going to do.
Nice. Well, that sounds like a plan.
You can do a random donut order, pick several you know, just make them random and they'll just throw in there whatever.
Hell yeah. And I'm sure if you do that, they probably, they know what people like, you know, what sells good, what people enjoy and stuff. It's probably worth it. You know, it's probably a let them pick is probably, it's like going to a restaurant and asking them, yeah, what their special is, you know?
Yeah. It's a chef special. So, yeah, so that's going to be fun. We're doing a raffle. We're going to give away some ebooks and training programs, that kind of stuff.
Oh, sweet. And,
I tell you, I've been just totally geeking out. I wish, like, one of the talks that I'm doing, the way we're kind of coupling it is I'm going to cover some bodybuilding pharmacology 101. So just kind of basics that a lot of people just, you never get. You hear all this varying opinions on varying things and bits and pieces kind of come across online, but you don't, without some formal training, it's very hard to assemble that into sort of a concrete body of knowledge with which you can understand things.
Yeah.
So if you haven't, you know, had formal training in a physiological, biological science, so you don't know what the hell's going on. So I've been putting that together and I've been actually finding out figuring some things out that I hadn't found before.
No kidding.
And yeah, and I've had to kind of condense this one talk down, only have, you know, an hour basically for that one. I want to have a little time for Q&A, and I'm thinking, man, I could do a whole day.
Oh, I bet you could.
Yeah, easily.
Yeah, easily. There's no question in my mind. You could do a whole day on one of our questions that we pose here, and you wouldn't run out of stuff to say. I'm sure of that. So
yeah,
no question. Yeah. If you're trying to cover an entire topic, and you know what, too, I'd like to feel like I understand the basics of the pharmacology. But I'm already certain that I'm going to learn something out of that. There's no question in my mind. I'm still going to pick stuff up.
Oh, I hope so. You know,
I'm sure of it.
There are some things, you know, that, I mean, there's only limited time. Like one of the cool things that I've been digging into more and more are the pharmacodynamics of the different steroids.
What does that mean?
So, pharmacology, you've got, I kind of break it down into pharmacokinetics, which is what the body does to the drug.
Okay.
So the drug comes into the body and the liver might break it down. It might have a half-life of X number of days or X number of hours.
Yeah.
It's metabolized to this metabolite, that metabolite, these other metabolites.
And they're all different, also, right?
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah, each parent compound, the original steroid, will have different metabolites into which it's broken down. There's kind of two phases in the liver that it goes through. There's like, you can talk about like distribution to the body tissues and how much is lost in the urine versus how much is lost in feces, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to go into all those details, but so that's the pharmacokinetics. The pharmacodynamics is what the drug does to the body. So that's the actions of the drug on the body and how it goes about exerting those. Like, what are the mechanisms whereby the drug brings about its pharmacological effects. And this is like, I mean, some just some really cool stuff. So I've mentioned these before. They're these competitive binding assays. And basically and the studies are done differently. So it can kind of make for a mess. Hold on just a second. Then I have a little drink here. There are some studies that are done with like purified receptors. And then they look to see to what extent the different androgens bind to those receptors. And then another study that's a lot of people have referred to, at least I think they have, like this information, you know, comes from these studies, but no one notes the studies. You don't know what the source is.
Right.
And in this case, they'll use like a tissue homogenate. So you'll compare like what happens in the prostate versus what happens in skeletal muscle.
Okay.
And in those homogenates, you've got enzymes that are affecting, they're breaking down and converting like 5-alpha reductase.
Yeah.
And enzymes that break down DHT, for instance, in skeletal muscle. So DHT really wouldn't be around to any large extent in skeletal muscle because there's not 5-alpha reductase there.
Okay.
Even if it does make its way there, the relative binding to the androgen receptor is going to be end up being poor in the full tissue because there are enzymes in there that break that down and prevent it. So you look at one study, it's like, well, how much does it bind? Just like basically ligand, the steroid and the receptor. And that'll tell you one thing. It's like, okay, like this is how, you know, you get 100%, you're like kind of standard for binding to the ANA receptor for DHT is 100.
Okay.
In a human androgen receptor. And then you look at DHT's binding in actual muscle tissue, and it's much less than that. It's closer to what you find with testosterone. It's like, well, what's going on there? Well, that DHT gets broken down. Skeletal muscle. So these are just like, I mean, this is stuff I won't go into in detail in those, in that presentation when I have time, but I sort of highlight that kind of stuff because that's the kind of confusing things that unless you've read the studies and you dig in to figure out how they did these things and read the discussions, you just kind of look at the tables and people will kind of like just pull the information they want. They'll see what they want to see. It's confirmation bias in many cases. And two studies will tell you two totally different things. And there's some other cool studies. These are really fucking cool.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, so you look at some of those studies, like the competitive binding studies, and you see that the orals, typically like Primo and Dianabol and Winstrol, Anadrol, et cetera, et cetera, they don't bind very tightly to the androgen receptor.
Yeah.
And that's in those tissue homogenates. The main study I've been able to dig up is in those tissue homogenates. You still kind of find that otherwise too. But here's kind of the interesting thing. There's another way to test that and see, you know, how the steroids are going about exerting their effects. And what they can do is use a virus that contains the code for an enzyme that produces, it's called a luciferase enzyme. It produces a luminescent protein that literally glows. It emits light, and you can measure that light, and that basically the extent to which that light comes on, the luminescence, is a marker, because these genes have been inserted downstream of where the androgen receptor would do its duty in the cell nucleus.
Okay.
So if you have an androgen receptor binding to the DNA and doing all of its business, which would eventually lead to protein synthesis and what have you, when you've got these virally infected cells that produce the luminescence, if you put an antigen in there and it binds the DNA, the more it binds the DNA and more it exerts these effects on mRNA transcription and translation, et cetera, the more the cell glows.
Okay. So
basically, it's like hooking up like kind of a rheostat light switch to the nuclear material of the cell, such that the more androgen action you have through the androgen receptor, the more the cell glows. And so they've done comparisons with like Trenbolone with Winstrol and Dianabol, and Trenbolone binds really tightly to the androgen receptor. Pretty much find that all the time. But people know that Dianabol, you can grow pretty well from Dianabol, and you can grow pretty well from Winstrol too. Not nearly as much necessarily. It's not known kind of for that. But with these transactivation acids, that's what this thing is called, with the luciferase, you can light up the cell like literally just as well with those orals compared to Tren,
which are not binding as tightly.
Well, according to one assay, but what matters is what's going on in terms of activity in the nucleus.
Yeah. So it's doing something, it's working the same or similar, but through is it a different mechanism or?
There's a different mechanism, and what actually is going on there isn't entirely known.
Interesting.
So it's like, you know, you've got a room and you want basically what ends up inside the room is reflective of what kind of anabolic activity you've got on mediated through the androgen receptor.
Yeah.
And you can end up with stuff in the room through one door or another door. And these different tests, different assays basically are examining what comes in through various doors, but we don't know how the doors get open and what the lock is to unlock the door. So I'll go into some of the androgen receptor issues, because there's a classical mechanism and a non-classical mechanism, and that's not entirely known. There's all sorts of pathways that are, as far as I know, haven't been really fully elucidated. But so that the thing that's kind of cool about that, aside from just being, you know, a way to kind of geek out on stuff, is that it, you know, if you just think, and we've had some questions here for the show before that say, you're talking about like, why not just use, you know, just one drug?
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, if these drugs don't bind tightly to androgen receptor, then all you really care about is androgen receptor binding. And that's looking at it just from the perspective of these single studies that, that, test like with a competitive binding assay, not a luciferase transactivation type of assay. So if you look at these other studies, it does show you that what we already know, what people have figured out, that Dianabol works.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the Tren and D-ball is going to be better than Tren alone, right?
Or test and D-ball. Yeah, like the machine say, you know, test and D-ball. So those mechanisms are in place. We don't know all the bits and pieces, but you we can definitely find that what's going on, the nitty-gritty of what's going on in the nucleus in terms of turning on the genes that are involved with an anabolic response are definitely that activity is definitely happening. It's just we're just not quite sure why it shows up in one assay but not in another.
I see.
So yeah, so this is conformational for the idea of stacking, you know, which guys figured out obviously a long time ago.
Right.
You know, the synergy between different drugs. Because you're turning on things through a different mechanism in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I get it. And now I see what you mean. This is by no means, like you called it, this is no means like the foundational stuff to me, but it is. It is. This is to understand this is to then, you know, have a basis for understanding why what I'm doing works. You know, I mean, I knew it worked. I knew, like you said, I knew that test and D-ball worked, but I couldn't tell you why. And if somebody were to approach me and say, hey, you know, that's not binding to the androgen receptor as well, all I could say is, well, I know it works before.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And you can wind your way through arguments and discussions about what could work and why something would work. And someone says, well, you know, why would you ever use like Anadrol? You know, it's bind in the competitive assay in that SART in this particular study. I mean, it doesn't bind for shit.
Yeah.
Like not at all. Like literally like less than 0.01% of the binding DHT. Yeah.
Wow.
But Anadrol obviously can produce some gains for people.
Yeah.
So if someone's just like looking at it through that limited data with the competitive binding assays, then they're not getting a fuller picture of what Anadrol could potentially be doing. So that's the interesting stuff. A lot of what I'm trying to do is just sort of give people some information that will give them perspective, so then they can kind of navigate their own path. You know, not tell them this is what you should do and this is why you should do it exactly, but here's some information, here's like, you know, here's a map, here's, you know, things to watch out for the map, here's the key to the map, and you know, take the path you want, and here's why you might want this path versus this path, et cetera.
I think that's great, and I've known that about you, Scott, since early on when we started doing PED together, was that's what you want, is for, you don't want to just give people the simple answer and tell them what to do with it. And I get it. It's a much richer process to be able to understand for yourself and to be able to decide for yourself and make your own decisions versus just blindly follow somebody else.
Yeah. And that's not for everybody. You know, some people just want, you know, they just want to be told what to do. And, you know, and I can, you know, understand that. Like the thing I think I've said before is, you know, I'm kind of a learner, like to learn things all the time. Like I spent a lot of time over, I've got a local mechanic here. His name's Mike's Garage in Temple Terrace. And he like works on all sorts of stuff. And I've spent like the night in his garage before. He's a workaholic. He works late and he likes to, we talk shop. I don't know really shit about cars, but we've worked our way through fixing generators and inverters on my RVs and talking about, like, you know, all the bits and pieces. And it's just fascinating to me. So I like to learn those sorts of things. I like to learn about the world around me, but some people are like, you know, I just want my car to drive and I want it to feel good. So don't even tell me, you know?
Right.
And that's a really good example because, you know, people, and this is, you know, the stereotype is a woman, and women tend to be more interested in people, and men are more interested in things, kind of on average. That's not obviously a hard and fast rule, but that's kind of a, you know, guys like tinkering with shit, and women are more people oriented.
Yeah.
In a certain way. So you have this sort of this stereotype of and it's not entirely true, of course, but that women can be easily, like, the mechanics see a woman come and they're like, okay, we're going to run up the bill. You know, you needed this, 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 and this, and this. You know, we put in 15 new filters for you.
Right, right.
You know, and that's an example of being taken advantage of in kind of a worst case scenario. But if someone, if you know enough about a car, or you're willing to work your way through the logic of it, where you say, okay, so, you know, 15 filters, why are there actually 15 filters in my car?
Right, right.
Filters replaced, and can I see the filters?
That's a start, right?
How dirty they were. Yeah. So that's kind of what I'm doing. And, you know, some people just like, hey, I don't give a crap. I'll pay a coach or whomever, whatever. And just like, I just want it to work. I want to just get bigger, and I don't want to have to think through the process. But other people want to be able to go in and, you know, if they want to change their own oil on their car.
Yeah.
You know, and they want to be able to talk with mechanic and do the kind of stuff I do when, you know, I'm up at Mike's place. Just, you know, and he's a real chatty guy. So he's, you know, we get along really well.
Yeah, that's cool. So, I remember it, and I think now that you're reflecting on this, it sounds like a much more pleasant experience. I remember last year around the Olympia, while it was happening, I don't think it was quite as pleasant of an experience at that time.
Oh, and the RV was breaking down.
You were like, stuff? Oh man, yeah. I'm stuck at the garage. And
yeah.
But at least you got something out of it, it sounds like.
Well, that was, yeah, that was because of my dogs, my older dog, you know, he couldn't move him around a whole lot. So I couldn't just, like, you know, be dragging him every place. But, yeah, that wasn't good. I was up there, just last week, you know, working on some other things, you know. And so, like, I'm going to probably put, I'm not sure if I'm going to do a lift. I'm definitely going to put some new shocks, and the cost of the shocks is the same as putting a lift in, pretty much, depending on what lift you get on my Jeep.
Yeah.
And I don't have, like, all the stuff I'd need, that, you know, I don't have the jack stands and that kind of stuff. I could buy them, you know, I could go, you know, spend $50 or $100 and find some used ones on Craigslist so that I could do the install myself. And it would probably take me like 8 hours.
Yeah.
You know, when normally it should take like 2. He said he'll put them in and I'll go help him. He doesn't mind, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, he'll let me help him. It's like, hey, can I asked him about this specifically, you know.
I could see a lot of mechanics just being like, nah, really? You can't be in the garage, you know, liability. Oh, yeah. Not to mention, it's like, this guy's just slowing me down type thing. Let me just... So that's really cool that you have that.
Oh, yeah, he's great. Like, he's not like your, you know, your franchise chain mechanic. He just has the one store. And he works on everything. We're kind of similar because he loves challenges. So like I can bring him anything. Like he's worked on, like I said, the generator. He's an auto mechanic, but you know, he'll work on your motorcycle. He'll work on your RV. He'll work on your boat.
Nice.
He'll work on your stereo. He doesn't care. Everything. He likes to, you know, figure things out.
Well, I need a mic here. I needed to get my tires road. I needed to get two new tires on my Mini. And get the tires rotated. I needed to get an alignment and get an oil change. You would think that wouldn't be very difficult, but I've made like 3 trips back. I had to get a tire patched, and a slow leak turned into an overnight flat, which it just so many issues, man. I need a mic around here is what I'm saying.
Look, I mean, like, I don't even know. I think I just drove by him because he's pretty close to me and found him that way. He might be listed. I'm sure he's listed in Yahoo or Yelp or what have you. But those guys, I always try to seek out the mom and pop type stores wherever I happen to live.
Which I didn't do that. I went to a big chain, which I was familiar with, you know, and that's the main reason I went there. And I went there with the mindset of just like you said, just fix it and, you know, give it back to me so I can drive my car. But in all honesty, man, you know what I compared it to too, in my mind, I was in there and these people were so busy. They looked very unhappy. And that kind of concerned me to begin with. They looked unhappy. They didn't look like they enjoyed their jobs and they looked like they were under stress. They had a waiting room full of people. And right now in Michigan, we had a big freeze and then everything thawed and there are potholes like the size of my car, basically. So everybody's having tire issues. You know, there's all sorts of problems and they're backed up. And it made me think of coaching, honestly, when coaches that kind of, they take on too much. And I think even sometimes it happens with people that have good intentions in coaching. You know, I know that I can get stressed sometimes because I end up taking on a lot or whatever, and which I'm not, I just said, I'm not going to do that anymore. But you take on a lot because you want to help everybody, but then you spread yourself too thin. I think this place spread themselves just too thin. I think they were probably decent people individually. They probably cared, but they don't have the time now to put the passion in like a guy like Mike does.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And it's hard. I think it's hard for because there's so much overhead, you know, in order to be like a standalone mechanic. And we took him a while, you know, to set this up. I don't, he's been there for decades, like I said, but you know, so a lot of those mechanics are really good people. They've been doing it for a long time, but when, you know, just constantly like oil change, that can be rough. But yeah, look around. You might find like there was, I used to go to, I think it was a Midas back in Tucson, but I would, there was one mechanic, I'm blanking on his name right now. I can see him in my mind's eye, but who would work on whatever. You know, I had several vehicles when I was out there and I just asked for him.
Yeah,
because I knew he was good. Like one, I had one interaction with him where he, you know, he took me back and he's like, "This is what's going on. This is what's going on. Here are your three options.
Yeah,
you know, you do this. This will mean you'll have to do this down the road. So it might cost you more in the long run, but it'll get you through the next 6 months and the trip you're going to take, and et cetera, et cetera." And I'm like, "This guy cares about what he's doing, and he's sharp. Mm. He's smart, you know."
Well, I got into a kind of, my mom got a little upset about this yesterday because I texted her and I told her what was going on with my car situation and how I got my tire fixed and then it went flat. And she insisted that I took it back to where I got it fixed. And she wanted me to like make it right and make them make it right. And I just felt like instead of doing that, I tried to do what you're talking about. I used it as an opportunity and I figured, okay, you know, I'm going to go somewhere else now and maybe try these other guys out. And I did find a smaller place that looks like a little bit more independent. They weren't quite as busy, but they look like they have a nice shop. And you know what? They took care of me and they were happy to tell me like what went wrong with the tire, why it wasn't fixed right the first time. Well, not at the same time. They didn't talk down about the people that tried to fix it, which I could see somebody doing that, you know?
Sure.
And it's a possibility that, although now I paid, you know, an extra few bucks to get this tire fixed, I might have actually found somebody who I will turn to in the future. Cause there's no question I'm going to have to get new tires in the future, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, it's going to take a while, but you're doing it right, man. That's, and if you go back in, you know, like, and your mom has a good point. I mean, you know, they should have fixed your tire. It sounds like it should have, you know, lasted longer than a day.
Right.
If you go back in there and you're kind of, it's just ends up sort of setting up some bad blood.
Yeah.
You know, like, and you, even if you're just the, and you're about as nice as a person could be, Scott, you're just one of the nicest guys I've ever known.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean that honestly, but even you go in there and be as nice as, you know, as nice as pie. And because of what happened, you know, it can end up making for a difficult issue. And then when you come back, it's like, oh, good God, it's this guy again.
Right, right.
And it wasn't anything you did. Like, it wasn't like you willed the tire to go flat.
Right.
But, you know.
And it's not like they wanted it to either, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Like with Mike, like we've had that happen. Like I had a gremlin in my Jeep and like I kept having to bring things back. There's several times and he just laughs. He kind of looks at it as an opportunity to learn more and figure things out.
What's a gremlin? Besides a movie, because I saw the movie.
Yeah, I always talk about, like, I'm not sure on this. Someone can probably Google it real quick and figure out. But I always sort of, I think the origin was, like, Gremlins. There's maybe even a movie that, like, Gremlins will get into playing.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was, like, a device or something.
I see.
Something that was, I gotcha.
A little monster that, you know, can't be found. Like, you can't really see Gremlins because they're not real, but it certainly should be doing something.
It was wreaking havoc for sure. I got you.
My electric was literally was cutting out. I'd be driving on the highway and my dash would be flashing and it was good. So, but anyway.
See, I was picturing like some sort of like Jeep specific winch or something like that called a gremlin.
You need to upgrade to the gremlin 2.0.
Exactly.
Chip in there.
Right. So, when are you heading down to the Arnold?
Up
for you, really.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I've got a butt crack of dawn flight on Wednesday. It's like at 5 or 6 o'clock.
Nice. Like
that, really early. Yeah. So I'll get in early. John and I are going to check out the venue, make sure everything's good there. And then we're going to, people can look forward to this too. We're going to do some training and do some Q&A. So I'll be on John's YouTube channel and I'll, you know, put the stuff on mine too. But
oh, sweet.
Yeah. So John and I are going to just, you know, I'm not even sure what he's going to ask. We just kind of wing it, you know.
Yeah.
We're talking about stuff.
Now this, your training, are you disclosing where this is happening? Is this something like where people could like kind of come out and train and watch you, but not ask questions while you're lifting weights type thing because you're trying to do your thing?
You know, I don't know. I mean, it's, you can obviously figure out where John's been training because, you know, he's at the same gym for all of his YouTube videos.
Okay.
But yeah, so I don't know.
Is this,
it's obviously not the Downtown Powerhouse. We're not even going to come near that place.
Right.
Cause it's just it's madhouse. But yeah, John's been going to American Barbell.
That's in Pinkerton.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Okay.
So a real nice place. He knows the owner, is a good guy. So, I mean, I don't know how far away that is, but I think the gym's kind of new. So, yeah, it could be a good place for people to go and train and get a little bit kind of off the grid so you can actually get a training session in.
Yeah, yeah. There's I'll be staying a little bit northwest of the downtown area, and I think it's called Worthington.
Yeah.
At Worthington, there's a Metro Fitness there.
Okay.
And one of our listeners, Steadfast Sarah on Instagram, works there, and she invited all of us over whenever if we want to come out and train at that gym, we're welcome there. So I'm probably going to come there to do a workout at one point, but I definitely want to get over there to American Barbell too. John posted that up, by the way, on his Mountain Dog Diet page on Facebook, that if you guys want to see him or, see a good gym there, that he said he'll probably be there every morning. So at Pinkerton American Barbell. So just a heads up for all you fellow John Meadows stalkers out there.
Yeah, it'll be, hopefully people come to train. It's always, I don't remember the first time I saw this, but, you know, it was an expo many years ago and it was, you know, I can't remember who even the first bodybuilder I saw do this, but when you've got like someone like Kai Green or someone like that, and they're just sort of in the, like the animal pit, you know, and they're just training and you have like 50 people standing around and watch. It's almost like a Muscle Beach type of thing.
But with
one person.
Yeah.
And everyone else standing around. And it's just an interesting thing. If the person's not doing some sort of tutorial to explain what they're doing, they're just training and everyone's just staring at them. It's just like, that's a really, really fascinating, from a psychological perspective, it's a really fascinating thing.
It is. From my perspective, as a fan and as somebody who looks up to, I'll use John in this situation, or yourself, I would be curious just to see you guys training firsthand because we talk about it a lot, and to see it would be another thing. Even if you weren't explaining what you're doing, I could pick up a lot. And honestly, when I first met Shelby, I didn't even think I'd train with him. I just thought to myself, you know what? I'd like to train in the same gym he's training in and just kind of be a fly on the wall and see how he focuses on his workout, see how he goes through his sets type thing, you know? And I think that you could pick up a lot from that kind of stuff. And I'm sure too, you know, all the listeners will be really respectful, right guys? And
yeah. Oh yeah.
And, you know, let everybody get their workouts in. But yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. If I could kind of run into you guys and kind of see what you guys are doing, that'd be cool. That'd be awesome. That'd be awesome too. You guys are going to do some video, it sounds like, and put that up on your YouTube as well as John's YouTube. I'm pumped for that, man. That'll be fun.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, I think we're going to put together a lot of content.
That'll be cool, man.
Yeah. John's going to be busy. He's got, you know, the whole week is like full with stuff. So got some people that are some of the athletes from Granite Supplements will be there staying with him, so they'll be filming some stuff. So
nice.
It's perfect, obviously, that he lives in Columbus.
Great headquarters then to work out of.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, exactly. So
speaking of some of those athletes, Luke Sandow, he's going to the Australian Arnold. Have you seen his pictures lately?
I saw one, I think, just not too long ago.
Dude, he's looking great, man.
Yeah.
We saw him last year.
Is his quad back now? Is he training full force with his quad? And we had a little bit of a tweak there.
They look good. While we're talking here, I'm going to pull his picture up that he posted, and I'll send it over to you. Put it this way. When I saw this picture, I didn't think to myself, oh, that leg looks off. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't catch my eye or anything like that.
It's the one in front of the fireplace.
I'm looking
at it on Instagram.
Okay. Yeah. With the bookshelf and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like his shape looks tighter this year than it did. We saw him last year at the Arnold. That was his pro debut, I believe, at the Arnold, Ohio. And I mean, he looked huge. Like, there was no question for a pro debut. That was amazing, because he didn't look like, well, he's just got to grow a couple years type thing. It was like, no, he's there. And maybe just a little bit of, you know, like him and Jordan had talked about, a few tweaks here and there. And, you know, from there, bring it in. I think he's got that now. He looks like a different bodybuilder, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different – people come in from different trajectories. The coaches will bring athletes in a different way. And I think Aceto, not all the time, but he likes to keep people in better shape maybe throughout the year.
Okay.
And I think that makes sense for Luke. I mean, if Luke's issue has been conditioning, you know, keep him closer to being ready.
Yeah, that does make sense.
Because he doesn't have – he's got plenty of muscle. You know, when I was sitting next to Jordan last year, you know, when we saw Luke on stage at the Arnold, and especially in the comparisons, we're like, he was outsizing everyone in his comparisons.
He was, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, he's there. You never quite know, you know, until you see everyone lined up side by side.
Yeah.
And that also goes to show you how good the amateurs are in the UK.
No kidding.
Yeah, because, you know, he obviously, you know, won the Brits, and that's how he got his card, and he fully deserved that. But it wasn't like he was like this gigantic mass monster, you know, who was way head and tails above everyone else.
It was still a battle.
Yeah, it was. It was. And so there's a lot of guys with it that are really friggin' big, who, you know, if and when they get their cards, will be up there battling. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope he left medialis?
I'm not 100% sure, to tell you the truth.
I'm just looking at, I see like a little bit of a divot there, but it's, you know, that would be my guess, but you know, that muscles have, you know, unique shapes that that could be from, that's just the way the muscle's shaped.
Yeah. Yeah, and without knowing that, okay, you know, I could kind of maybe see it a little bit. When you point it out, you know, but that's that's nothing. It doesn't jump out at me at all, you know.
Oh no. I mean, that's like, you know, you could look at Jay Cutler's pictures, for instance, and see, you know, his weaker leg.
Okay.
He always, you know, he always put forth the one like that I think from not his last Olympia, but the second to last one, the last one that he won. There's that shot with him,
with
a straight leg thigh that, like, you see, that's the most used picture of him.
Yeah.
His color is just like really phenomenal, and the striations are, you know, in that I think it was his left thigh was just phenomenal. It was like, just like, that's one of the best quads of all time. He always showed that one, you know, because the other one was smaller. I think I've mentioned this before, but it's kind of a cool thing to do. You can take, like in that picture, even with Luke, someone could do this if you want, Luke could, is you take a picture like that and you split the pick down the middle and take the left and right halves and reverse them. So you make a Luke out of two left sides and a Luke out of two right sides, and then compare those two versions. It's kind of freaky because you see, like, it's like, well, which is the real Luke, you know, like, is this Luke? but you can see, and there'll be, when you do that, there'll be a substantial difference.
Yeah.
You can see, you know, what you don't see when you're looking at the regular image of the person, which side is more developed in which areas. Like, one pec will be bigger than the other. So you'll see both pecs are bigger with the image that's been made from that side with the larger pec.
Right. I've never done that before. That's a great idea, though. Yeah.
It's really freaky. Yeah, you should do it. Do it with your own pictures. Like, if you have like a most muscular or front double bicep or what have you.
Yeah. You know, have you ever done that with yours?
I have, yeah.
No kidding. I'm going to actually probably get on that today. I'll be on Photoshop messing around with that. I mean, I already can see. I already know, you know, a couple areas that are more dominant on one side than the other. None of us are perfectly symmetrical. And, of course, I've had my shoulder injury on one side, and that's kind of changed things a little bit. Although, I will say that some of it wasn't necessarily even muscle size or shape. It was just the way the muscle was sitting due to spasm and stuff like that. So some of the work I've had done has actually kind of changed the muscle, which is cool. But yeah, no question, man. I'd love to actually see what I already know, I guess, and maybe see some new things too.
It accentuates the asymmetry.
Yeah, I bet.
It almost like it's like, oh shit, really? Is that bad? I didn't know that, you know. But it's also insightful because then you can know how to pose.
Yeah.
To disguise those weaknesses. There's a guy that an old friend of mine, haven't talked to him for years, but he's from LA, but he competed at the Arizona one year. He's a friend of a friend. And he had, I don't remember the name of the disorder. It was really kind of interesting. But he had an asymmetry of muscular development that was greater the further distal you went on his limbs. So yeah, I'll explain that. I was just kind of given the sort of technical description. So I can't remember which side was, but let's say his left side was smaller than his right side. It may have been I think his right side was smaller than the left side. And the pecs, because they're closer to the midline of the body in this particular disorder that he had, whatever it was, it was more kind of a sort of a muscular syndrome, I guess, in a way. But the pecs were about the same size. You couldn't see much difference in the pecs, left versus right. And the delts, you know, that's a little more distal. You're still at the, you know, at the beginning of the limb with a little bit of a difference. And then the arms, you could see a difference for sure in the left versus the right side. And then there was an extraordinary difference in the forearms.
Oh, really?
His bigger forearm was, he had a really well-developed forearm. It was tremendous. And the other forearm looked like, you know, it had been casted.
Wow.
Relatively speaking, yeah. And the same thing on his legs. Like one calf was much smaller than the other, and the thighs a little bit, and the glutes really from behind you couldn't really see much.
Huh.
So yeah, the more distal you went on the limb, the greater the asymmetry in terms of muscle size.
I see.
And his arms were awesome on the side that was the well developed side.
Yeah,
his arms were badass, and the huge forearm that created this really powerful look on that side. So he would do. He had to do quarter turns the way you normally would.
Sure.
But he was a master at disguising this. So when he'd do his quarter turns, when it would be time to show his weak side, he would always, like they say, quarter turn to the right. And if it was coming around to his weak side, he would wait just a little bit so that he was like the last one to turn.
Yep.
He hardly ever held that. That pose was just almost infinitesimally short, so the judges never really got to look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then of course when they're showing the strong side, he would anticipate when the quarter turn was happening so he could hold it.
Yeah.
Then he would show the triceps. He would kick the tricep a couple times, to show that size there and draw attention to him when they're seeing his good side.
Yeah.
And even when he would do his front relaxed poses, he would do them sort of a side stance to a little bit to a certain degree. You know, he put the weaker leg, the one to be the support leg, and the larger leg kind of flared out. The same thing on the other side. So it was sort of a kind of a classic bodybuilding type of relaxed front pose. And when he would pose, he'd walk out on stage and like he would hit like a like let's say he did like a one side would be like a lat spread, the other side a single arm bicep. He would show that side, and let's say the left side's bigger, so the left side would be up, and you'd see that arm. The other one would be down at his hip, and then he'd be turned a little bit, so the stronger side was close to the audience, and it was sort of front. And then when he would turn to a side chest, that side that was stronger was always closest to the audience. He'd sit at side tricep that way, and when he turned to the rear, he was always a little bit twisted. It looked very classic and flowing.
Yeah.
You couldn't tell what he was doing. You'd never know by the way he was posing, just by the posing per se. But it was all geared towards really just displaying the strong side the entire time.
That's interesting.
Keeping the smaller side kind of hidden behind the rest of his body.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was. I mean, he won the Arizona. You know, he was the champion that year. He won the show.
Nice.
So yeah, he went on. I think he got like 10th USA or something like that.
Oh hey, before we went to break, I wanted to just briefly mention too. I brought up Jordan. We were hanging out with him last year. You know, I've had a lot of people ask, you know, where is Jordan? Is Jordan coming back? What's going on? And you know, the truth of the matter is that he's really busy and he's got his own stuff going on. So he's always welcome back to the show. You know, we'd love to have him, you know, but you know, for the most part, Scott and I want to just keep things moving forward. And I think that we've been doing, you know, we've been trying to evolve it. You know, he hasn't been around as much. So I feel like we've been evolving it and that's the game plan. So moving forward, we probably won't have him, but if he ever wants to come back, you know, he's always welcome. There's no bad blood, anything like that. So there's no reason to start any rumors, you know, it's just a matter of the guy's busy. And you know what else too? He's got so much going on with his stuff with Trained by JP and he can put out so much content on a regular basis. Coming to do this 1 hour show, you know, it's really kind of like on our time schedule versus he could do his stuff in the gym constantly or at home constantly, whenever he wants to and has his camera crew around, you know, so it's just a matter of that. And, you know, he guy doesn't need us anymore. Guess that's what it comes down to.
Well, I mean, you know, Jordan's site is awesome. I don't know if people haven't subscribed to it. I think it's totally worth it.
I know a lot of our listeners are subscribers and have been because, yeah, a lot of people are really big Jordan fans and for good reason. So I know a lot of them already are. But if you guys haven't, definitely check it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And he posted a really nice thing. Someone had asked him on his discussion board and he's got a cool discussion board with some training logs with Luke and Sasan Harati's on there.
Yeah.
James Hollingshead also has and of course, Corin.
Yep.
They've all got their own threads, and they keep them pretty active. But, Jordan someone had asked him who the people he learned the most from over the years, and he paid me a really high compliment.
That's cool.
So yeah, it was fun. And just to say, just to sort of underline how busy he is and how popular he's become, which is just phenomenal. He did that, and of course, I got like, you know, 150 follows in like
the next
2 or 3 hours. Yeah, it was just like boom, 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 boom on Instagram.
Wow.
So yeah. So he's just kicking butt. And I'll fingers crossed. I think we've got it worked out that I'll be back at Body Power.
Yeah.
This year, yeah, I think that's gonna end up working out. And I remember even last year. You know, Jordan, they had him emceeing a PCA show that was there.
Yeah.
And they had like, they had double booked him for being like two places at once.
Oh,
so I think I filled in for at least one and I think actually two of his presentations. I just like went and just stood in his stead, because he couldn't be at two places at once. and, yeah, but no one minded. I don't think.
Yeah.
I didn't get any complaints, but it was just interesting to watch. That was last year. And since then he's become even more popular and he just, you know, he's just got a sort of a really major following over there. So he's doing what the circumstances really kind of demand him to do, which is to try to, provide as much information he can, given his popularity level. He's got an awesome opportunity to really influence a lot of people in a positive way. So he's taking full advantage of that. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I think we totally get it because we see that on the level of knowing how all of this stuff takes time, you know, whether you and that's kind of our, you know, our most valuable commodity. And, you know, so I totally get it. And I'm sure that the listeners have to, you know, understand that, too. So I'm happy for all the stuff that we've been able to do. I'm sure that we'll get him back at some point in the future. I'd love to catch up and see what he's up to, you know.
Special, super extra special guest.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. We'll bring him on again.
And, but I feel super confident in what we've been doing too. I feel like that, it's allowed us to explore some new things and we've had some cool guests on, which we didn't do that before. And, it's kind of taken things in a new direction. Plus we are taking questions now over at your form, Integrative Bodybuilding. And, right. You know, we're gathering a lot of stuff up. So I just feel like we have some good momentum, and it's good. The thing about podcasting is it's always changing, you know, and if you want it to be, if you have it fixed in your head how things are going to be, then that's when it dies, you know. And I've seen so many podcasts in my lifetime in bodybuilding die because they didn't evolve, you know.
Yeah.
And yep. I guess that's probably key with a lot of things in life, you know. But being open-minded and creative with things, I think that you can continue to blossom and grow and develop new stuff. So that's my take on it, at least.
Yeah, yeah. Just go with the flow, you know.
Yeah. So what do you say?
True at all times is that this too shall pass, and that can be good or bad. But
yes,
everything is transient.
Yeah, I had been told in the past that the Buddhist monks look at, and this is specifically about emotion, as being like they try to be like an open house with all the windows and doors open, because things are going to blow in, and whether that's a good smell or a bad smell, you know, whether it's a good emotion or a bad emotion, things are going to blow in, and they're also going to blow through the house if you wait long enough. So it's a matter mm-hmm. of just time, because things are always going to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everyone listening to this, I always like to tell people this when they're kind of like thinking, oh man, like I don't know if I can handle this, what's going on. So far, everyone listening to this has a 100% perfect score on handling everything that life has brought. Like everyone's got a perfect score, so congrats. So far, you've been able to tackle every single moment.
Yeah,
one way or another. So, and here you are. So
I like that.
Yeah, you're pretty badass if you made it this far. And a lot of people have and also were badass, but you know, you're kicking butt. So just keep it up and everything will be fine.
All right, let's take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we got a bunch of questions.
Cool.
Hey guys, this is John Meadows.
And this is Scott Stevenson.
I invite everybody to come out to our seminar, Bodybuilding Fact and Fiction.
Thursday, March 1st at the DoubleTree Suites in downtown Columbus. Just before the Arnold Classic festivities, come on in and meet John Meadows, IFBB Pro, the Mountain Dog himself, and Dr. Scott Stevenson. Stay all day from 9 a.m. to noon, then after lunch, 1 o'clock till 4. Starting out with an a.m. pancake breakfast, then all-day lectures. Q&A as time permits, plus best bar ever and pre-workout from Granite Supplement Speed Force to get you on your way to the gym. For more information, go to drscottstevenson.com. That's drscottstevenson.com. And hope to see you guys there. If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at fortitudetraining.net. And if you order any of his products or services, you get a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. Go to fortitudetraining.net to learn more about all these products, services, and events offered by Scott Stevenson.
All right, guys, and welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm Scott McNally with Dr. Scott Stevenson. We've got a bunch of questions lined up here, and believe it or not, Scott, we're actually kind of catching up, I think. We're getting close.
Yeah. Yep. Just trailing behind the stream of questions.
Yes. So to start us out, this is a question about anti-inflammatory supplements and food. He says, typically, I take a few anti-inflammatory supplements like sulforaphane or curcumin, especially when blasting. I do this for health purposes. However, I have read that consuming things of this nature or even doing anti-inflammatory things like taking cold showers can significantly diminish muscle gains. Is there some way around this? Plus, does this mean that many healthy activities that reduce inflammation are in fact bad for bodybuilding? Thanks a bunch. And this is from Jeff Sessions over at the Advices Radio Forums.
So this is just this is a really, really cool question because there's so much involved with this. So here's kind of the deal. So a mindset that many people have, of course, and this sort of makes sense, and this is sort of what gets people into bodybuilding and oftentimes makes them really good bodybuilders in the end, is that more is better. Mm. And that's not always the case. So one of the things that sulforaphane, curcumin, many herbs that have adaptogenic actions or that have anti-inflammatory actions or free radical quenching actions, they act through what's called the NRF2 pathway. And this basically will go in and bind, kind of like launches this sort of cellular wide antioxidant response that will limit inflammation in the cell and take care of the cell. Hmm. What he's sort of getting at here is that, I think he is at least, is that you want to have part of the what triggers and is the stimulus for the adaptive processes we want in muscle is some inflammation. There has to be, you know, something that tells the cell, hey, there is a stress here.
Yeah.
There's some damage. There's something that must be adapted to so we can protect against this future stress. So if you use like just, you know, flat out antioxidants like vitamin C and vitamin E in like mega doses. So like if someone used like 400, I use a vitamin E and 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C, you can literally prevent the increases in glucose tolerance, increases in insulin sensitivity, and prevent the mitochondrial biogenesis that comes from training. You basically sort of blunt the training response if you do that. So you don't want to do that. Anti-inflammatories like NSAIDs that block the cyclooxygenase enzyme, and there are herbs too that will block COX, that enzyme, and lipoxygenase. I believe curcumin has actions there. Maybe that it. I have to go and look that back up because there's so much overlap. Some of these are impacting the expression of those enzymes as well. But some of the things that help with joints affect those pathways. And if you block those, you flat out block them with like ibuprofen or naproxen or something like that.
Yeah.
You can prevent the things like satellite cell proliferation and muscle protein synthesis that happens after you train. Literally, you block those things. So that's like with full out blocking. So the idea of hormesis is that you've kind of got this inverted U response to the amount of stress or inflammation or free radical stress that you've produced. So they're going to get a greater adaptation if you have sort of a sweet spot in terms of the amount of inflammation that's produced. If it's that there's none, well, you're not going to get an adaptation. There's nothing to trigger the cell to make an adaptation for the muscle cell to grow in our case. And if it's too much, then you also won't get an adaptation. So you want to kind of find that sweet spot. So if you like just flat out block inflammation with like an NSAID, you can create an issue. Or if you were to just drive the thing, you take a whole bunch of anti-inflammatory supplements like sulforaphane and curcumin, you can actually be turning on that NRF pathway so strongly that you're blocking everything and you're possibly preventing the inflammation that you want. And this is kind of what he's getting at. So there's a cool study, even though with all these studies, there's several studies now looking at satellite cell proliferation and animals and humans and muscle protein synthesis getting blunted by NSAIDs. There was a study in older folks, and aged muscle seems to be more prone to injury. Some of that's age and some of it's inactivity. There's one study, it was done at Ball State, that found that the group that was taking an NSAID actually had better muscle growth over
really?
The course. Like, yeah, several months of training. Yeah, they grew better. And my guess is this was they looked at there's some prostaglandin involvement here because that's what cyclooxygenase is involved with, prostaglandin synthesis, that kind of complicated the story. But my guess is that they sort of maybe because they're older, something about the training, whatever the circumstances were, they ended up by using that anti-inflammatory, sort of moving the limiting the inflammation, so it was just closer to the sweet spot for optimizing muscle growth. So they got better muscle growth. So to get to his question, if you're using too many anti-inflammatories, and you can end up blunting some of the key processes that are involved with producing muscle growth. So you don't want to do that. If he absolutely needs the, there's reasons for these, you know, for health reasons, because free radicals are probably involved with aging, for instance.
Sure.
Now that's the kind of like the some of the hypotheses as to how and why we age is that, you know, free radical damage accumulates over time. So, and you can increase lifespan in like fruit flies and that kind of thing if you upregulate their free radical quenching enzymes. So there's some evidence, there's all sorts of evidence that points in the direction of, you know, free radical stress being a cause of aging. So you want to kind of limit that. But you want, like, part of what we're doing with bodybuilding is we're creating a stimulus for growth. So you're stressing the system. I mean, exercise in and of itself, just like doing cardio, increases superoxide production. Like, that's just like one of the certain small percentage of the of oxygen of will end up as a superoxide radical just from doing endurance exercise. And the aging theory behind that is this rate of living hypothesis. And this is actually why fasting slows things down. If you fast, metabolism gets slower, your rate of living is reduced, and you live longer. This is why people are doing intermittent fasting, that kind of stuff. It doesn't seem to be as powerful effect in primates as it is in other models.
Okay.
And the idea would be then if you live fast, you live hard, so to speak, and you're doing a lot of exercise, your rate of living is faster, your energy turnover is faster, free radical stress is greater. So it's hard to say. You want to have some inflammation. That's part of what you're trying to do when you're triggering muscle growth.
Right.
But if you load up on too many of these anti-inflammatories, he's got the question right. Does this mean that many of these healthy activities that reduce inflammation are in fact bad for bodybuilding? Yes, that's very highly possible. And there's not enough data that I know of, and especially with kind of the poly supplementation that people are using, where they're just taking everything under the sun,
right?
Just all sorts of anti-inflammatory stuff. Then you can run into issues with not being able to really evoke the cellular stimulus that you need to get an adaptation. There's something like a kind of a side topic here that I've kind of come across that's sort of been floating my boat. I'll throw this in here. And it relates to muscle soreness. There's a really nice review that came out like in the last year or so that I read. And I'm probably going to do an entire podcast maybe and talk about this. Someone else wanted me to go on their podcast. We'll see if that happens. But
nice.
So there's some studies that initially they would do things like measure myofibrillar protein synthesis at the beginning of a training period. And you would expect that, you know, the people who can turn on protein synthesis the best on day one when they start their training, those are the people who are going to take the largest steps forward in accumulating protein in the cells and with each and every workout. And the people who are taking big steps at the beginning are going to be the ones that end up with the most muscle growth by the end of the training program. That doesn't pan out.
No.
When you measure initially, no. But so the question is, like, how representative is of what is the muscle protein synthesis, myofibrillar protein synthesis at the beginning of a novel training program? So this is in the context where someone hasn't been training, they start training, of course you get sore.
Sure.
Right off the bat. And there's a repeated bout effect. The muscle soreness gets reduced. Some cellular mechanisms come in, and you basically develop some protection against that inflammatory response. There's not nearly as much muscle breakdown, so you don't get sore as much.
Yeah.
You kept going and doing the same workout all the time. The first time you did it, you get really sore. It's like, you know, the trainers that bring someone into the gym and they want to kind of impress their new client, and they, you know, they run them through this crazy ringer in the gym and they're just like crippled.
Right. For a
week. Like, that's just, you know, idiotic. There's no, like, one set, two or three reps shy of failure is plenty for each muscle group the first day into the gym if you haven't been training for a while or ever. So what was probably going on in these studies when they measure protein synthesis at the start of a new training program is that protein synthesis was reflective of the muscle damage that was going on and just the repair process associated with the muscle damage. It wasn't reflective of muscle protein synthesis that was going towards accumulating protein, accumulating myofibrillar protein, contractile protein, inside cells over the course of time. So one particular, I think Domus is the first name, if people like to look this stuff up. And they measure like at the beginning and then three and then like at the end of like 8 or 12 weeks of their training. And at 3 weeks and at 12 weeks, the protein synthetic response that they got was highly, like the correlations were like 0.8, 0.9, highly correlated with the eventual muscle growth.
Okay.
So what the hell does this mean? Like, okay, so that's kind of cool, Scott. You got to go off on a little soapbox about muscle biology.
But I'm waiting for it.
Yeah, I know. Okay, the punchline. So look, the interesting thing there, at least from my perspective, is that when you're really, really sore and you're producing a lot of damage, if you're kind of sore all the time, for instance, like this is where I'm kind of extending this information. It hasn't been, I haven't seen the study directly, but when you're sore, a lot of the protein synthesis is just basically going to repair of the damage that comes about as part of the inflammatory response. So with inflammation, you'll get a lot of proteolysis and breakdown. So your muscle protein synthetic response, if you're always sore, a good chunk of that is going towards just repairing the damaged tissue, not accumulating muscle protein time. So it makes me there. This isn't always the case. There are probably people that, you know, this may be the case for you, who have muscles that are really strong points for them, and they don't get sore a lot in those muscles.
I can relate to that.
Yeah, is that true for one of your muscles, like your calves?
Well, I don't really train those, but I can think to certain areas that I can train and that they don't get as sore as others, or more so, I can tell you there are certain body parts of mine that get very, very sore more than average.
Mm-hmm. Are those ones strong points or weak points, relatively speaking?
Let's see. I would say it's tough to say. I don't think I have any strong points, Scott.
relatively speaking, which are the least weak of all the weak points?
I would say that my biceps don't get very sore.
Uh-huh.
And my biceps are not a very strong body part.
Not a strong. Okay. So that can be the other thing, is you don't activate them well. So this is why this is a paradox. Like for me, for instance, my posterior deltoids, I do train them.
That's a good one. Yeah.
And I have trained them in the past. And for me, those are good. Like some people, like for instance, you know, John, I remember, you know, John and I have talked a lot about all sorts of things. And for him, like one of the things he'd always do backstage, I helped him out at a couple shows, and he'd always like pumping up his rear delts were really important to create that kind of 3D look from the side.
Yeah. And you know what? That's one for me. I have very strong rear delts and they never get sore ever.
And they're big. By strong. Yeah. Yeah. So, and same thing with me too. And so that fits with this idea that you're still getting some stimulus there, obviously, but it's not in a way so that they're constantly sore and you've got this sort of constant battle of repair whereby the protein synthesis is going towards just kind of keeping up rather than getting ahead in terms of muscle size.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's kind of the interesting thing, and that's a thing like – when I kind of pieced this together, this is just something, I think I read this article just a few weeks ago, like I've noticed that my chest has always been a weak muscle group for me, and I can just make it sore as hell. I can make anything really sore, to be honest, if I just like try to destroy it.
Yeah.
but my chest will be sore an awful lot. It seems to stay sore. And the thing that I wonder about it, there has to be some limit to what the protein synthetic machinery in the cell can do. So you can only like turn on myofibrillar protein synthesis at some maximal rate. So if muscle is always sore, or even just, you know, maybe sore than others, and the listeners can kind of sort of, I'd love to hear feedback. If they can kind of think through, you know, from head to toe, the muscle groups that grow well versus don't, those that don't. If you've always sore and you've got some like kind of maximal protein synthetic capacity that you're constantly losing some of to the simple repair process because the muscle's always sore, then you're limiting growth.
Yeah, I see that now.
Yeah. So that's kind of the idea. Back to this kind of question, and this is why this is related, is that, you know, that muscle breakdown, which has to be, of course, balanced by muscle protein synthesis in order to at least kind of break even, not to mention get ahead, the breakdown is in part due to the inflammatory response. Some of it from training is just like literally there's mechanical breakdown of the myofilaments. Like you just you know, create some mechanical damage. But then there's, you know, some proteolysis that goes in because the cell's gotta clean things up to keep the sarcomeres in register, so that you can have a functional muscle cell that can contract. You know, that all the protein's not all cattywampus in there.
Yeah. So I think I'm getting this.
Yeah. So like this is another sort of perspective on having the kind of appropriate amount of inflammation, so that you're not constantly having to like turn on, like max out your, or use up so much of your protein synthetic capacity,
just trying to
balance all the proteolysis, all the breakdown that's coming from training so much or too much, and or just having too much inflammation for whatever reason, because you're just in generally an inflammatory place in your body, like your foods are generally inflammatory or what have you.
And just like my bro guess here, I would have to think that if you wanted to somehow balance that out and kind of control inflammation a little better, something like curcumin would be better than a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, you know?
I think so. Yeah.
I'm guessing.
I that's always been my thought too, is that the things that turn on NRF and the antioxidant response element and that basically elicit within the cell their own anti-inflammatory capacities, are you're feeding into, you know, the homeostatic mechanisms in the cell.
Yeah.
So you're like sort of priming the system, but the system is still, you know, capable of balancing itself. It's not like a blunt, like vitamin C is a great example. It's just there, and it's going to be, you know, quenching free radicals because it's there, and there's nothing to balance it out. It's just there. It's like, it's doing its thing until finally it's cleared from the system. Whereas this is a way to sort of push the system, but you've still got homeostatic balance in place so that the system can still regulate itself to some degree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, do you take any of these types of supplements on a regular basis in your own life?
Yeah, I take curcumin.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, if I have, like, because, you know, I'm always like, I've got some little niggle going on now and again.
Some sort of gremlin?
that's the UK term of like a little aching pain, the niggle.
Yeah. And gremlin. That's my new word now.
Yeah. There you go. A little gremlin. Yeah. Then I'll up the dose, you know, take like a BCM 95, you know, 400 or 600 milligrams on an empty stomach.
Okay.
Kind of as an NSAID to help keep the inflammation under control.
And that's the Super Bio curcumin?
Yeah. There's various places that sell that BCM 95 form, but that's the one I use, the life extension.
That's what I use too. I've been using it for probably closer to 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no single point where I could say like, oh wow, that really reduced inflammation, or I felt better, or I healed that injury quicker, or something like that. There's no point where I could say that. But just reflecting back in hindsight over this period of time that I've been using it, I feel like my body has just functioned better.
Mm.
I feel like it's made a difference.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. It's hard to know. You know, you probably are doing all sorts of other things too.
Right.
But have you ever tried taking like 600 or 800 milligrams? Like, let's say when you're like, you just killed yourself and you're like, I'm going to be sore. Like, this is going to, it's coming.
Well, from what I understand, it can be beneficial for illness, for like with like bacteria and stuff.
Yeah.
I've increased it when I've been sick. That's the only time I've increased it. And I do feel like that it helped me, like that my symptoms started to reduce faster in a couple of situations where I had like an upper respiratory infection. I haven't tried it with training though. And I feel like I want to do that now. And it's probably going to happen in the next week at the Arnold when I train legs.
Okay. Yeah. You have to, I'm pretty certain about this. It's just playing it around and looking at the bioavailability study that's out there, is that you need to take it on an empty stomach.
Okay, really?
Yeah, because that helps with the absorption. There's kind of, curcumin can be working kind of in two sort of major ways. One, I think this is what happens with the BCM95, is that it's highly absorbable and it gets into the bloodstream.
Okay.
And then some of the other forms of curcumin, they may be having some of their impact on the microbiome.
Mm.
So they might not be as bioavailable in terms of entering the bloodstream, but the microbiome is very important for inflammation as well.
Interesting. So, because I have a friend that has IC, interstitial cystitis, and she found that she gets pain reduction from taking curcumin. But she doesn't like the super bio curcumin. She'll take other forms of it and she'll take more of it, obviously. But she found that the other forms at high doses work better for her for pain relief than taking super bio curcumin. I don't know why, but maybe it's working through a different mechanism, like you were saying, through the gut biome.
Yeah.
Just guessing here, you know?
Yeah. It could very well be the microbiome. You have to see. I mean, she may have digestive issues.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Which I know that, like, for a lot of people with interstitial cystitis, that it, a lot of things, digestional stuff, the foods they eat and stuff will have an effect and create more inflammation. So that's why it triggered me, like a light bulb went off that made sense. Why? Because I'd always wondered why it didn't work as well for her. And she preferred other versions, but that just kind of, I'm thinking out loud here. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the way to do it, man. I think, it's going to be so really cool to find out more and more about how we can use the microbiome to impact our health.
Yeah.
Because the symbiosis there with all the bacteria, we know it's different in athletes versus sedentary people. So kind of more healthy people versus those who aren't so healthy. Hmm. You know, they're using fecal transplants.
Oh yeah.
Into people, you know, that are overweight, like, cause that's, they don't know how else to, we don't know how to sort of like influence the bacterial populations in the microbiome really any other way other than just sort of take some poop from someone who's got what you want and put it in someone who doesn't have a healthy, healthy colonies.
Which is so weird, but it's working.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. It is kind of strange, but diet can change. There's a really cool study, ZV is it. It's, that's one I'm going to talk about at the thing in the Arnold at the okay. Arnold. Yeah. Where they looked at the several different bacteria in the gut and how they change as people's diets change. So they had like a crappy week with a shitty diet and then a good week with a good diet. And basically you see inverse changes in certain bacteria depending on what the diet's like. And that also reflects, it also changes it kind of in parallel with changes in insulin sensitivity and glucose responsiveness and all those sorts of things.
Interesting.
So your gut microbiome changes. I mean, how many people like go from their off season where they're just packing in the food and they're really pushing their GI to its limits. And at least for the first part of a diet, when they clean up their diet, like their GI is great.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing really, really good. So some of that's got to be the microbiome.
Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah. I could tell you that I feel like my digestive system is, I have like two completely different digestive systems from dieting to off season.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're just like, you know, you're constantly running the fan in the bathroom off season. and yeah, you're normal otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, regular and everything else. So yeah, so that'll be cool, but it's God, there's just this mountain of information to pour through because there's so many different bacteria there. We don't even like and they're all interrelating with one another. Like literally it's like figuring out like, you know, we've got vertebrates and invertebrates, and all of a sudden we've got this microbiome. It's like, holy shit, there's all these different species to try to figure out. Like there's so much information there, so it'll be pretty cool to see how that, you know, gets uncovered in the next decades.
I'll go to one more question here. We made that into a pretty, I think, substantial topic. That was really good. This one is about growth hormone. He says, a question about exogenous GH injected into a joint capsule. Would the GH only affect the joint, or can it cross the joint capsule membrane and enter the bloodstream and become systemic? Since the joint capsule is this word avascular?
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that it would stay in the joint? Thanks. And this is from Dawn of Justice.
Dawn of Justice. So
new Dawn. Well,
my first thought would be, man, if your joints are so bad that you're wanting to risk an infection by injecting GH, then, you know, definitely I'd go see a doctor, you know, see what's going on. I don't know what he's got going on to do in his joints that he's trying to impact. You know, GH can be very helpful for joints. It increases connective tissue protein synthesis. So, you know, it can help some of the structures in joints.
Hmm.
So, you know, I don't know what would happen, to the GH once it's in there, if it would just slowly degrade. I don't know what sort of proteolytic enzymes are in synovial fluid. So you've got a joint. I'm sort of thinking about the knee here, but who knows where he wants to go. And you've got a capsule that surrounds it. And yeah, the capsule is avascular. It's just basically connective tissue and cells and collagen, various connective tissue fibers. But the synovial fluid, there is flow of synovial fluid. It does. It's not like the joint capsule is completely, literally encapsulated the joint, and the synovial fluid just sits in there, you know, from the time you're born to the time you die. The synovial fluid turns over. There is actually synovial fluid flow. So you're making new synovial fluid, and the old stuff is, you know, making its way out, eventually, you know, leaves the body. So there's going to be some flow there. So the GH, I don't know if it would be broken down in the synovial fluid or not. I'm really not sure. But it may end up making its way into the blood. That would be like probably I can't think of a kind of a worse way to introduce growth hormone into the body, because you'd be constantly, you know, having to use sterile technique, you know, to try to make sure you don't create an infection.
Yeah.
There isn't a lot of good. That's why getting a joint an infection in the joint is really a bad thing. Because there is poor blood flow there, you're not going to be able to get cells of the immune system in there. So if you introduce some bacteria and it starts wreaking havoc, and infection starts growing, then it's got like this. It's got a nice little safe covey in which to multiply. And so that bacteria grows and grows and grows in the joint, and then, you know, eventually it'll make its way out into the bloodstream. And because it's sort of shielded from the immune system in the joint, it can sort of release, you know, the rest of its evil gremlins into the into the bloodstream, and then you can end up going septic even if you went, you know, waited too long. Septicemic bacteria in the blood, you don't want to have that. So I definitely wouldn't do that at all. But I don't know what structure he's wanting to try to help here. So the GH, you know, can get, obviously people find, you know, growth hormone will help with their joints. So it will make its way to those structures in the joints, because that's what growth hormone does. It's involved with, you know, bone growth during growth and development and connective tissue growth. So it's going to get there. Normally growth hormone, the growth hormones, there's several of them, make their way through the blood to get to the joint. So it's a more direct way to administer it, but not definitely one you wouldn't want to do on a regular basis. That's typically, that's when people are doing like a hyaluronic acid injection, yeah, or something like, it's the kind of a one time, or a cortisone injection. Like, you, like, okay, we can do this once, but we don't want to like be going into the joint on a regular basis and risking, you know, multiple holes in the joint capsule through which bacteria can make their way in.
Yeah. I'm kind of cringing and like holding my elbows and knees while you're talking about this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've done, it's a technique in Chinese medicine to really do, to needle the joint capsule. I've needled people's joint capsules.
Whew. Well, I guess it's a different story. You're a trained practitioner versus I'm just a guy, a bro at home, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying anyone should go and do that, but I have done it, and it can be very helpful in the right circumstances, but it's not like the first order of treatment. You know, it's not like the first thing I think of when someone's got a bad knee, like, oh, we'll just stick a needle in there.
Yeah.
Cause you do have to use sterile technique, not just clean, but like truly sterile. So
you ever hear of, do you remember, and I remember seeing this on the message boards a while back. It was a natural product, and I think it was derived from shellfish. Yes, that was it. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard anything about that stuff? I had heard of people using it, and it's over the counter. Like I said, natural product. And I think that, you know, don't quote me on this, but I thought people were putting that into the joint itself.
Yeah. I mean, if you like read the package insert on that or the descriptions, you could use it that way. I wouldn't suggest people do that again.
Just right.
It's a risk, but it works really well.
Really?
It does work well. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. You can, it's from Romania, I think.
Yeah. Originally. That's what it was. It's all coming back to me now.
Yeah. They label it as bioactive fish extract, I think, something like that.
Ooh.
And it does have hyaluronic acid in it as well.
Oh, okay. So that might be part of what's making it work.
Or maybe it has hyaluronidase, which would catalyze the formation of hyaluronic acid. But one of the two, I can't remember.
Okay.
But yeah, that does work. That typically, like, I think it's weird because it comes in amps.
Yeah.
Of like 10 to a package, and like the protocol is to do it for 21 days. So it's like, okay, I'll buy 2 amps, and then I'll just have a third amp, and I'll have 9 left when I'm done. Something. It's just kind of like, buy 21.
Yeah.
There was some study that I haven't been able to find. I haven't looked for a while, but where they probably used, 3 weeks, which is 21 days. So,
okay.
But yeah, that does, there's all sorts of cool, like people use some equine stuff like pentosan sulfate, and there's like canine adequin, which works really well. And of course everyone knows about BPC 157 and TV 500.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of cool joint stuff out there.
Now, I wonder too, I mean, I feel like, and this is once again, because I'm coming at this from a bro perspective. So, growth hormone, if you're having joint issues, is it going to be possible that just taking a standard intramuscular injection could potentially help problems with these joints? I mean, I know it can benefit connective tissue, right? So I don't know.
I think here's the thing. I mean, and this is like, I had this perspective long before that, but in Chinese medicine, for instance, there's this idea that you treat both the root and the branch.
Hmm.
So like if you have an issue, some sort of, it would be like a disharmony or a deficiency or what have you in Chinese medicine, or you've got some aches and pains, bad joints or whatever. And if you're a bodybuilder, the branch are the symptoms.
Yeah.
And what's going on. And the root is the cause.
Okay.
So like why is it that your joints hurt? Like are you like insisting on squatting?
Right. You're doing skull crushers with 150.
Oh, that makes my elbows. I haven't been able to do those since I was a kid. Like I never could do those.
Yeah.
They always bothered my elbows. Like literally from the get-go.
You know what? I do them with dumbbells and I'll do them unilaterally together,
Yeah.
And they never bother my elbows. I think it's just my wrist positioning.
Okay. Yeah. I tried them that way too. I may have to give it a go again, but But yeah, so the thing that a lot of people will do is they want to keep on doing what they've been doing, because, you know, we can be creatures of habit.
Sure.
And like, if it's something like a squat or skull crushers, it's like this is like this, there's this big dude, like a ball, to get big legs, you have to squat. I was asked that question on Instagram just a few days ago. Or there's this guy, the biggest tricep I've ever seen. He used to do skull crushers with 2 1/4. So, I have to work up to that, you know, because that's what he does. And there's some logic to that that makes sense.
Sure. And but, if you could handle that, it probably would work.
Yeah, of course. Right. But not everyone's, you know, built to squat. It's not going to be their exercise for putting on big legs. I mean, there's guys like this guy with named Jordan Peters. He's got some pretty decent legs, and Jordan doesn't squat anymore. Dorian stopped squatting. Dorian had some pretty good wheels.
Right.
Yeah. So you can do this. So people will keep on doing, it could be a training related thing. It could be a dietary related thing. It could be just simply they don't take enough cruises. They don't deload as they should. Hmm. This is like one thing I've intentionally like built into fortitude training. And I tell people all the time is that, you know, you find exercises when you're doing the muscle round days and the pump sets in particular, and this even comes with the loading sets as well, is like, just use some common sense. If you're starting to have an ache and a pain that every time you do this exercise, then just don't do it.
Yeah. Just that makes total sense.
Find something else. So, you know, this person may have had an injury, you know, that he's trying to rehab. And that's kind of a different deal. Like if he's got like acute traumatic injury of some sort, then, you know, that's a different situation than someone, which is, I think, probably the majority of cases with bad joints is that they're just trying to like Band-Aid. They're trying to treat the branch without going to the root of the problem. And that's what you got to do. At the same time, you do, you know, a multi-pronged approach. And I get this, I mean, literally like every month I have a question like this, like somewhere I get asked the question, and I just say, you got to just stop doing the stuff that makes it hurt.
Yeah.
It's literally like, that's why the Band-Aid is such a great analogy. It's like, you know, I keep on bleeding. I was like, well, you know, stop cutting yourself, and then you won't need to use Band-Aids to cover up the wound.
Yeah.
You know, the root is, the issue is that you're cutting yourself. So put the knife away, you know, and you won't have any more bleeding wounds to cover up with Band-Aids.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I think that takes, you know what, right there, that comes down, Scott, to what we started talking about figuring things out for yourself, you know, and I have a hard time just telling a client, here's a training plan, follow this split. Because I don't know if they're going to respond the way I respond to those exercises, you know, and I'd hate for them to do this for 12 weeks and not change anything and not adjust it, just thinking, oh, well, this is what Scott said you should do. This is exactly what I'm going to do, versus, you know, figuring it out for yourself. And like you said, tinkering and figuring out, you know, what does work for you, just as importantly, what doesn't, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's about seeing beyond the paradigm of the time. So like one of my favorite examples of a paradigm shift is, or the lack thereof, is a bicycle seat. I may have mentioned this before. Sorry if I'm telling the same old stories.
It's not coming to me yet.
Okay. All right, good. So the bicycle was sort of an alternative to riding a horse.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So a horse's saddle obviously has to go around the horse. You know, he's got to go around the horse's body. That's why it's shaped the way it is.
Sure.
So then, you know, your standard bicycle seat, has like this sort of, like, think of your regular, you know, guy's bicycle seat. It's got this post that goes to the middle that kind of goes between your legs.
Yeah.
Well, other than creating pressure on your prostate and reducing your sperm count, what have you, what's the purpose of that post?
Yeah.
It's there. It, as far as I know, it lingers there as a residual from the paradigm of making a bike as an alternative to a horse.
Hmm.
So we just had to sort of fit that within people's sort of concept of what a bike would do for them. They made the seat look like a horse saddle.
Hmm.
The seat should look like your butt.
Yeah.
You don't need to fit it. There's no body of a horse to fit it around. And they make bicycle seats that are like that. They actually make them with like two pads that move back and forth that fit on your glutes.
No kidding.
Like when you're cycling, yeah, you can find them, you know. And they're like, they're ergonomic bike seats because they fit the human body. As opposed to that post, like literally there are data showing reduction in sperm count in elites or people who are cyclists.
Because, I've heard that.
Yeah, it's because you got a lot of it's the heat part of it is, you know, that, you know, there's an optimal temperature for spermatogenesis. And so you've got all that, you know, you don't have good airflow up in there because you got all this heat, you know, up on the testes. So anyway, like that, there's people haven't made the paradigm shift entirely. The shift is to say, I don't need this to look like a horse's seat. So apply that to weight training. And you know, the whole thing we're doing is just trying to load the muscle. You know, and you can pick it up and put it down. And, you know, barbells, you know, because of the, obviously, you know, you can put weights on either end and they're straight. You know, that was, an ideal barbell, and they have these now, you know, might actually sort of be bent in a way that kind of fits over your shoulders on your traps.
Yeah,
kinda
like I can see that.
The manta rays do, like you can put on the bars
yeah.
or pads. But like a straight bar, like that's not ergonomic for actually holding the weight there.
No, it's not at all.
not even close. No, it's just a bar, you know. But people don't look outside the paradigm. And the reason that bar is there is like that's easy to manufacture.
Yeah.
You know, making straight barbells for, you know, I don't know when the barbell was first invented, but it's got to be over a century. So, and the same thing goes, you know, with equipment. This is why I have all these videos on my Instagram. Showing people alternative exercises that they can kind of do, because we see, you know, the paradigm is developed by the equipment manufacturers, and they all sort of copycat one another.
Yeah,
it's so rare to see someone who's come out with a machine that's different than the other ones.
Plus, I think that the clients, the customers, would have to accept mentally that their bar was going to look different than, you know, we know what a barbell looks like in our minds, you know?
Right. That's the paradigm.
Yeah.
You're stuck in that paradigm. Like you can't see, like, why would I, this thing's okay. It's an alternative to a horse. So I see why the seat's like that. It makes sense. I can climb on this and not feel like this is weird.
Yeah. I'm looking at the easy seat right now. Dual pad bike seat.
Yeah. Yep. That's the one. I think I've Googled it. Yeah. Pretty cool. So one thing that is like so advantageous, you know, that's a little bit sort of a breach from the paradigm is like a prone hamstring curl. So remember like the old school hamstring curls, like on like an old Nautilus set, and it's like a flat bench.
Mm-hmm.
And now most hamstring seated or lying hamstring curl machines have a bend where your hips go.
Yeah.
Right? Because your hips tend to want to come off the seat.
Absolutely.
And that feels more comfortable. That fits better, and it's such a dramatic difference, and it fits so much better with the human strength curve of the hamstrings, because normally hamstrings don't, during normal like running and jumping movements, the hamstrings are a biarticular joint. They're a biarticular muscle. They cross two joints, so they don't change length very much.
Mm.
So like a hamstring curl is it's not a very common movement. You know, you don't really do that during the course of locomotion or running and jumping, things that are legs were evolved to do.
Interesting. I didn't realize that, but it makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's called Lombard's paradox. So like, you know, like your quad, when you stand up, like from a seated position, your quad shortens as your knee extends, right?
Right.
And then like, you know, your hamstrings, when you do like a stiff legged deadlift, when you come up on the stiff legged deadlift, they're shortening across the hip.
Sure.
Right. But when you extend at the knee, your hamstrings lengthen, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So when you stand up from a chair and you extend at the hip and extend at the knee, the hamstrings are shortening at the hip and lengthening at the knee.
So they're staying the same, more or less.
They're pretty much the same. Yeah, they're pretty much, they don't change in length. They basically perform isometric contractions to translate momentum across the hip joint to the knee joint. They like basically allow the hip extensor power of the glutes to be translated to the knee joint. It helps with jumping. That's why you see And sprinting. That's why you see really good sprinters have gigantic glutes and pretty well-developed hamstrings too. That's why they tear their hamstrings so often when there are people who are running. So a hamstring curl in the gym is just a weird thing, man. It's a weird, bizarre thing. And like lying flat on a bench like that just doesn't feel that great. So that's why CAMs were so good, you know, Arthur Jones' invention. But also just putting that kip for the hips on a prone hamstring curl.
Yeah.
It just feels so good, but that's much more ergonomic and sort of biomechanically sound, for a natural feeling hamstring curl, because it's such an unnatural movement in terms of what the hamstrings normally do.
Yeah. I can see it now that you say it. I never thought that, never noticed that before. That's so weird.
Yeah. That Lombard's paradox, I described that like the muscle architecture and physiology classes, and people are like, oh man, it's like tripping me out. I can't wrap my brain around that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, yeah. So that's the thing. I'm not sure how we got on this, but that's the thing with, you know, exercise. Here it is, the exercises and finding what works for you. You know, it's okay to not do these standardized exercises if they're causing, you know, chondromalacia, you know, telefemoral issues, or your joints are just killing you when you do overhead presses or whatever. You can find another way, because, you know, look outside the paradigm, think outside the box.
I like that. And yeah. I have to imagine too, that no matter what, if this guy has suffered an injury, or if this is just a repetitive thing, that there's got to be something in that for him. You know, I mean, there's always a workaround.
Yeah, I mean, it can take a long time. But yeah, I hope so.
I hope so too.
Follow up, you know, maybe we can help him out more. But I hope he hasn't already. Well, maybe he did and he got through it. But I hope he didn't inject anything into his joint and give himself an infection.
Yes,
that would suck.
All right. Well, we're about out of time here. I got to pack. We got to get going. This show is coming out on Thursday. This is going to be actually the day of the seminar. So that's
right.
Pretty cool. That's yeah, I think that's kind of exciting. So if you guys are listening when the show comes out, you're not there, but if you're listening after that, then you possibly were there with us, and I hope that you stopped and said hi. I want to meet everybody who listens to the show, and I think we're all going to have a really great time. I'm excited to hear what you have to say, Scott. I'm definitely excited to hear what John has to say. This is going to be an awesome weekend.
Yeah, John sent me his presentation, so we compared notes on what we were talking about, so we could integrate our talks, and his is pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah, and don't forget to mention, because people will be at the Arnold, maybe, that the get-together.
Oh, yeah, so that's right, at the Arnold, on Saturday, we are going to have a meetup at the Best Bar Ever booth. Did you say that's booth 912, Scott?
Yeah, that's what I see on Instagram here.
Okay, booth 912. That'll be the Best Bar Ever booth. We're going to meet up at 10 o'clock, and this will be on Saturday morning. So this will be before prejudging at the Best Bar Ever booth. Stop by. Scott, are you going to be there?
I'm planning on it, yeah.
All right, cool. So
Best
bar breakfast ever, yes. And that'll be fun, man. It's going to be a great day, too. I know we'll have a chance to meet a lot of the listeners, and then after that, I'm going to head over to prejudging. Are you going to prejudging too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we can go en masse.
Perfect. That'll be great. Guys, stop over, say hi, over the Best Bar Ever booth. That'll be once again, 10 AM at booth 912. We'll probably hang out there for an hour or so, and then, make our way over to prejudging. So it's going to be a good weekend, man. Like I said, I'm pumped, and I can't wait to see you there. I can't wait to see everybody there. This will be fun.
It's going to be awesome. I'll see you soon, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Dave.
Travel safe.
You too.
All right, guys. For another episode of Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, I'm Scott McNally, and we will see you at the end.
Nice.